Welcome to the Secular Lotus Buddhists podcast. That's kind of a mouthful, isn't it? So just getting started with the podcast, I was actually inspired by my new friend, Reverend Sederman, who is a Nichiren Shu Buddhist priest in Seattle, who has a great podcast that I would recommend called The Rowdy Buddhist, R-O-W-D-Y. Really awesome stuff. He's a really awesome guy and very smart and enlightened, I would say. So I recommend his podcast. Look him up. So there's been lately, over the past, I don't know how many years, maybe like the past 10 years especially, but there's been kind of a growing kind of grassroots-like movement, especially in the West, of what's been called secular Buddhism. The former Buddhist priest Stephen Batchelor, who lives in the UK and has written several books about his experiences with Buddhism and about how he has come to define himself as a secular Buddhist. So essentially, you know, to oversimplify, secular Buddhism is kind of looking at Buddhism and, you know, there are several different schools of Buddhism, Mahayana, Theravada, and then within those there are various schools and sects and divisions, not too much unlike how in the Christian world, you know, there's Roman Catholic, Greek Orthodox, and then there's, you know, Anglican, Episcopalian, Lutheran, Presbyterian, Methodist, Baptist, and on and on, right? So there's a similar phenomenon in Buddhism. And most of that has been regional-based over the past 2,500 years as Buddhism spread, especially through Asia, you know, and different teachers were teaching and spreading Buddhism, and then they would kind of incorporate some aspects maybe of their former native religion from their region, so you know, aspects of Shintoism or Taoism or Confucianism or Hinduism into Buddhism. So, you know, there's been an argument for quite some time that Buddhism is not really a religion per se. Technically, it's more of a philosophy or a way of life. Sorry, my animals are acting up and playing. But there is, you know, so I think, you know, the count of, with Buddhism being so old, about 2,500 years old, Buddha died about 2,400 or so years ago, around 400 BCE, I think, when he was 80. You know, I think the number of Buddhist scriptures or, you know, texts that are considered sacred or holy or, you know, vital to Buddhism and to different schools of Buddhism, I think they certainly number, you know, anywhere from 80,000 to over 100,000. I mean, it's a lot. You know, numerous sutras and then numerous other writings and then guides to those writings and sutras and analyses and by different schools and priests and monks and philosophers and so on and so forth. So, but for those of us who are non-theistic or atheist or agnostic, sometimes don't feel comfortable with. So not only is just in Buddhism, but maybe in any other religion, you know. So for example, Judeo-Christian, you know, so Judaism, Christianity, Islam, with kind of these ideas of gods and deities and angels and demons and magic spells and supernatural and resurrections from the dead and reincarnation and rebirth and miracles and, you know, all of this stuff, right? That kind of defies science. And so inside the secular Buddhism movement, I mean, there are varying opinions, of course, but for the most part, the unifying thing is that, you know, I would say most of us are identify either as being non-theistic, atheistic, or agnostic. But we are attracted to the philosophical and ethical ideas and practices and actually way of life that Buddhism teaches, or at least Buddha's core teachings. So with our kind of grassroots new school of particular flavor of secular Buddhism, which we're calling secular Lotus Buddhism, is an offshoot from Nichiren Shonin or Nichiren Dai Shonin, depending on, you know, which background you're coming from, about his honorific title, who was a 13th century Japanese priest, originally from the Tendai school, who developed his own school of Buddhism called Nichiren Buddhism. And that has divided into, I think there are three main divisions, but the third one, I'm sorry, I can't recall the name of, but the primary one, well, so four actually, I guess. So because there's Nichiren Shoshu, which I am still technically a member of, and then there's Nichiren Shu, which I mentioned earlier. My friend, Reverend Sederman in Seattle, is a Nichiren Shu priest. And then there is SGI, Soka Gakkai, which used to be, I think, up until the 1990s, kind of part of Nichiren Shoshu, but they were excommunicated for a whole host of various political and other reasons. By Nichiren Shoshu, the Nichiren Shoshu High Priest. So they operate independently now. So I would say secular Lotus Buddhists, our group or movement, is an offshoot of that Nichiren school of Buddhism that's based on the Lotus Sutra. The Lotus Sutra was Buddha's final teaching before he died. At around age 80, around 400 or so BCE. The dates are a little debatable. And so our practice is kind of based on the Lotus Sutra and borrow. So even though we are not religious per se or theistic, we do meditative type practices that are based on the Lotus Sutra and some ideas coming from Nichiren himself. So, you know, we say Daimoku, which is the Japanese word for basically a repetitive chant. You may have heard it before. There are several famous people. Orlando Bloom, Tina Turner, the famous kind of R&B rock star who now lives in Switzerland, is a Nichiren Buddhist She is Soka Gakkai. Orlando Bloom, the actor, is also SGI, Soka Gakkai. So you may have seen YouTube videos, and I've posted some of them on our Facebook page and on our website. So you can find our Facebook page by just searching for Secular Lotus Buddhists. And then our website is secularlotusbuddhists, plural, .org on the web. Our website is currently under maintenance, and I'm being told that it should be back up later tonight. Some changes are being made to it. The main chant that we have is basically pronouncing the title of the Lotus Sutra in using its Chinese characters, but pronounced in a Japanese way. So, Nam Myoho Renge Kyo, Nam Myoho Renge Kyo. So that is our mantra that we repeat for varying amounts of time, anywhere from 3 to 5 minutes to 10 hours a day, if someone is really devoted. And so for people who aren't secular Nichiren Buddhists, who are, Nichiren Choshu or Nichiren Shu, or even SGI, when they're chanting it, to them it's not just a meditation, it's a prayer, worshipful, and they pray to the Gahanzan, which is kind of this parchment, or sometimes they're on wood, inscription that Nichiren Daishonin invented with all types of Japanese, and I believe also Chinese characters and calligraphy, very beautiful to look at, which has the title of the Lotus Sutra kind of going down the center, and then around the sides there are kind of all these different elements that are very complex and use allegorical, or at least what those of us who are secular would consider to be allegorical or mythical, comments, or about creatures or protectors or angels or demons, or all of that stuff. Those of us who are secular, when we meditate, we're not praying to anyone or anything. We are simply meditating and focusing our mind. And some of us do use the Gahanzan as just kind of a visual focus and as a symbol and representation of the Lotus Sutra and, the teachings in the Lotus Sutra. But those of us who are secular don't believe the Gahanzan has any special magical powers, or that praying to it grants you benefits, or, any of these things that some people who are non-secular Nichiren Buddhists believe. And then we also chant Gangyo, which is typically twice daily, once in the morning and once in the evening, along with Daimoku, chanting the title of the, so chanting Nam-myoho Renge-kyo, and then also chanting chapters 2 and 16, which are called the Hoben and the Juryo chapters of the Lotus Sutra. Just traditionally, those are chanted using their Chinese characters pronounced in a Japanese way. So, for example, if you've heard Gangyo before, and the most familiar and the easiest to do or to learn is chapter 2, the Hoben chapter, which is in English, the chapter of skillful or expedient means. And it kind of sounds like this: Myoho Renge Kyo Hoben Pandai Ni. So it's a very rhythmical kind of, has kind of like the rhythm and the meter of like a galloping horse. Some Nichiren Buddhists say Gangyo at warp speed, and then others, especially beginners, chant at a slower speed, you know, Myo Ho Renge Kyo Ho Ben Pondai Ni. And then others chant Myo Ho Renge Kyo Ho Ben Pondai Ni, need to, you know, very like, I'm not a super fast chanter, but you know, to the point where it's like tongue tied and you can't even really differentiate the syllables. I'm not really a big fan of that warp speed chanting. I would chant at what I would say is a moderate speed. You know, so we have a ritual, so we have borrowed those some of those practices. So you know, having like a butsudan, which is the Japanese word for an altar, with maybe a gahanzan, or maybe a statue of Shakyamuni Buddha, and then you know, sitting either on a chair or on a floor cushion or kneeling in front of this meditation, what we call a meditation table rather than an altar. Altar seems to imply, you know, worship and deities. And we just kind of stare at that, almost how Zen practitioners kind of half close their eyes and stare kind of at a blank point on the wall. We stare at the Butsudan or the Gahanzan or the statue of the Buddha while we are chanting Daimoku or Gangyo. And it really is, you know, for us, it's just a ritualized meditation and mind focus practice. It's not prayers. It's, you know, we're not worshiping anything. We're not praying to anyone or anything. Just a way to focus our minds, and in addition to, you know, having kind of this slightly ritualized meditation practice with some accessories, you know, on the meditation table. You know, and we have bells and incense and some people have taiko drums or mukugyo, I think is the Japanese word for the to keep rhythm. It's like a percussion stick, and you beat the stick, and you the leader kind of taps the stick to help the chanters kind of keep in a synchronized rhythm. Some people also use the drum for that, the Japanese taiko drum. So we do that. And then also, in addition to the meditation practice, of course, you know, it's important to read, you know, the Lotus Sutra and other writings where the Buddha, especially the ones where Buddha is actually speaking, most of those are called sutras. So a few of the famous sutras prior to the Lotus Sutra were the Heart Sutra, the Diamond Sutra, and there's a whole, you know, very long list of those. Buddha did not himself write any of those. He spoke those orally, and then they were kind of passed on by oral tradition. And I, you know, probably not written down until 100 or 200 years after his death. And maybe like the 1st century AD. And I think those were originally written down in Sanskrit or Pali, Pali, you know, regional languages in India, which is where Buddha was born and taught. And then eventually, you know, they spread and got put into Chinese and Japanese and Korean and Vietnamese and Cambodian and other Asian languages. A lot of those writings didn't actually become available in English until the 19th century and the 1800s. So, for example, the first But I think the Lotus Sutra, for example, I have a copy of it because I speak French like I do English. But the first Western version of the Lotus Sutra, not in an Asian or Indian language, I think wasn't done. It was at 1859 or 1959. But relatively recently, right? So, it used to be that in order to read Buddhist texts, you really, until the 20th, 19th, 18th century, if you were not Asian, you really had to learn Asian languages or Sanskrit or Pali, languages from India in order to be able to read and understand these texts. So thankfully now a lot of them are translated into English and Western languages, but not all. So those are good to read, especially the ones where Buddha is actually speaking. So within the secular Buddhism community, there is, so most of us have heard of the telephone game, right? So, especially as kids, right? So, you get maybe like 10 kids lined up, and then the first kid tells a very short story, and then, kind of whispers it to the kid behind him. And then that kid whispers the story to the kid behind him or her. And then by the time you get to the very last kid in the line, the story has been altered, changed, exaggerated, or things are missing, or so that is part of the tradition, I think, in any major religion where they're oral memorization instead of writing down these things as they happened occurred. And so, it's thought within secular Buddhism that when you read some of these texts, like, so for example, the Lotus Sutra, and there's, kind of like these deified creatures, bodhisattvas, and they're floating in the air. And then there's the medicinal Buddha, and then there's like the treasure Buddha inside the stupa while the original Buddha is speaking and floating in the air. And, there's a lot of kind of magical, mythical, allegorical type stuff going on. And some Buddhists who are non-secular, who are more theistic Buddhists, Tibetan Buddhism is in particular, maybe Tibetan or Pure Land Buddhism is maybe the what I would consider maybe the most theistic or, kind of supernatural tendencies. But some of these writers and even current practitioners and priests in those traditions actually take those things to be literal. That these people really were floating in the air, and there really are demons and angels and protectors, and that Gohonzons have kind of supernatural or metaphysical properties that grant benefits when you chant to them. In Nitran Choshu, the Gohonzon is called the object of worship, which I, not to be disrespectful toward Nitran Choshu, but which I personally don't believe. I mean, I certainly believe, that it's, I was talking with a friend the other day, and who's also a Buddhist, and I said, the way I look at the Gohonzon kind of is that it's something that I, it's a symbol and I revere it because it has, all kinds of like symbolism of like things that I, philosophies that I believe in and try to practice as a way of life. But I don't revere it really any more than I revere, like, I have a painting, for example, on my wall of my late mother, and, I don't believe my mother is actually inside that painting, or that I can talk to the painting, or that her painting has any special powers, or that she's inside the painting, or, but I mean, I respect the painting because it's a memory or a symbol of my mom before she passed away a few years ago. So to me, in a secular sense, it's kind of like removing all of the telephone game type stuff. And I think we also have to remember that, during the time that Buddha was teaching, so he was born in India, and into a very wealthy, royal family. I think he had even a prince title. And so when he left that life, to go out kind of seeking the truth, and saw all the suffering and the hunger and the poverty and the begging and the, homelessness and the, not too much unlike things that we see today still in the world. Sickness, death, grieving, just suffering in general. So kind of a focus of Buddha's teachings was that, there's a lot of suffering in the world, and that human beings and sentient beings suffer, and that there are ways that we can ease suffering, not only for ourselves, but for others to help ease their suffering or even possibly eliminate it. And that as you go through this iterative process, so Buddha's teachings were, as he explained in his last teaching, the Lotus Sutra in chapter 2, where he talks about expedient means or skillful means, is basically what he was explaining in a nutshell, and this is extremely oversimplified and paraphrased, is that he was explaining to his followers that, throughout the, 50 or 60 years or whatever it was that he was out, speaking to the public and kind of preaching and teaching, and that while he would tell these parables, which there are so many of, that he wasn't lying when he was telling those stories, but he was explaining that as the years went by, and depending on which audience he was talking to and where and what the contextual background of their existing lives were, what religious beliefs did these people have? What cultural practices did they have? That he modified his teaching to include aspects of their culture and their religion to kind of surround his core teachings, right? So some of his core teachings, which I won't go into naming them, but the three basic ones, I guess, to start off with, were the three jewels, which is taking refuge in the Buddha himself, his teachings, and Sangha, which is the community. And then later on, he expressed the Four Noble Truths. And then expounding from that, he went to the Eightfold Path. And then just over time and over the decades, it was like iterative. And when I say iterative, kind of think of like stair steps. Like he wasn't, in my personal belief, I don't think maybe that Buddha's awakening or enlightenment or what we might call today in the 21st century being woke. I mean, I know that generally kind of the story or the maybe the allegorical version of the story is that he sat under the Bodhi tree and that he was kind of instantaneously enlightened. But I think as a secular Buddhist, I believe that he iteratively or gradually took steps toward becoming more and more enlightened based on more suffering, more experiences, more interactions with humans as he went on. And as he continued to practice, he was also evidently a Vedic kind of medical practitioner, using Ayurvedic type medicine from India, and then he was also kind of a yoga guru. And so, lots of meditation, lots of, that kind of stuff, in addition to the life experiences that he was having outside of the palace, just kind of wandering, and seeing how people were living and suffering and trying to help them. So I think that, in a nutshell, in the Mahayana school of Buddhism, which kind of encompasses, many different individual schools underneath that, kind of like Mahayana would be the equivalent of maybe like Protestantism, whereas another school, for example, Theravada, might be, for example, Roman Catholic. I mean, it's not an exact analogy, but that's a similar enough analogy, I guess. And so, just like how in Protestantism, there are Methodists and Presbyterians and Lutherans, and having grown up Lutheran myself, even within Lutheranism, there's all these different divisions of which synod of Lutheranism. I grew up in Missouri Synod Lutheranism. There were the ELCA and, all these, the Wisconsin Synod, and, all these different divisions. So Buddhism is a little bit like that as well. And so I think as part of the secular Buddhist movement, which is kind of a grassroots movement at this point, I think still growing, I would encourage you to look up Stephen Batchelor. So he spells Stephen with a PH, and then Batchelor is spelled BATCHELOR. Very interesting guy, very learned guy, very enlightened, and has a lot to say about, his experiences prior to coming out as an atheist or secular Buddhist, and having been an ordained priest. I think, if I recall correctly, he was an ordained Zen Buddhism priest, but it may have been a different Buddhism school. So, basically, what is Buddhism? It's not magic. It's considered a religion, but it's really, at least from our secular point of view, I mean, it's really more of a system of philosophy and ethics and well-being, health and well-being, and a way of living your life. And how you treat others and how they treat you, and how we respect other people, compassion, kindness, empathy, respect, dignity, a lot of that kind of stuff. And as a longtime Bernie Sanders supporter politically here in the US, kind of similar to some of the concepts that Bernie Sanders has brought up during his his 2016 and his 2020 presidential campaigns, which sadly both have failed. That's a whole other subject. But this us, not me, help someone you don't know. That a lot of those kind of philosophies that Bernie and his followers, including myself, espoused are almost, are quasi-Buddhist, really. And I used to joke with some of my Buddhist friends that I was convinced that Bernie Sanders and Dr. Jane Sanders, his wife, were what we call in Buddhism bodhisattvas. And so bodhisattvas are a word used to, in Buddhist writings to describe people who are becoming enlightened. They're on a path to enlightenment, and so they've reached a certain level of wokeness or enlightenment or, awakened, aware, self-awareness. And they come across as kind of very empathetic, compassionate, kind, caring people. So I think, that was a joke that I made. I don't think that Bernie and Dr. Jane Sanders have been anywhere in any Buddhist school, officially declared as bodhisattvas. But really, from our secular standpoint, we're all bodhisattvas. We all have a Buddha nature, which I know sounds kind of mystical and magical, but it's not. It basically means that we all have the ability or capability to become better people. And to become more self-aware and aware of what's going on around the world and how we interact with others and the world itself and our environment. In some other schools of Buddhism and certainly in Hinduism, there's kind of this concept of reincarnation and then karma, which exists. I mean, those concepts exist in both Hinduism and Buddhism. So from a secular Buddhist point of view, I mean, we don't believe in literal reincarnation or rebirth. We might very well accept a more scientific version of that, not even metaphysical, but scientific, where, when you die, and depending on whether you're buried or cremated or buried at sea or whatever that may be, right? Your body decomposes, and the molecules and everything kind of go back into the system and become fertilizer for the trees, or and there's kind of this kind of Stephen Hawking type of concept where we're all made up of stardust that is billions and billions of years old, right? And that, when we pass away, we kind of become just floating molecules, and the stardust floats around, and it might fertilize or help some other being feed it or fertilize it or whatever. I don't think any of us who are secular Buddhists believe that, if we when we pass away, that we come back as a dog or as a cat or as a worm or as a snake or as a human being, or that people can remember their past lives or any of that kind of stuff. When I talk about that stuff, I'm not trying to be disrespectful toward people who believe those things, but I'm just saying that from a secular point of view, where science and evidence and proof are pretty important concepts. I think for those of us who are secular Buddhists, that we understand that those are in the stories and in the Buddhist writings and things, but that they're, I think they were, I don't even know if the people who were writing them believed that literally. I think it was just kind of used as kind of metaphor or allegorical, mythical usage. But in any case, we don't need to believe in any of those things. And actually, I believe there were multiple times throughout his life that Buddha's followers would ask him, about rebirth or reincarnation, and he would just kind of answer, again, I'm paraphrasing, that it was irrelevant because, why does it matter? In other words, like if you can become woke or awakened or enlightened in this lifetime, why does it, it's kind of irrelevant. It's kind of an irrelevant question. Basically just live this life, and focus on this life, and doing, doing good, trying to do good on, unto others and yourself and the planet and the environment around you during this life. Don't worry about 10 lives ago, if those even existed, or what you'll do a million years from now if you're a worm or a cat or, I mean, I think that Buddha was just kind of politely, because he was talking to practicing Hindus, that he was trying to basically discount that stuff without being disrespectful, by just kind of brushing it off and saying, well, this is really irrelevant and this is what we need to focus on. And so what I would say too is that for people who are listening and who maybe don't know a lot about Buddhism or who know a little bit about Buddhism and maybe have kind of felt like a slight inclination to Buddhism, like maybe they've read about Zen Buddhism or maybe they've taken yoga, which is kind of sort of related to Buddhism and Hinduism, yoga kind of coming out of that region from India. So the whole yoga namaste, that om, chanting and things like that. I mean, these things are all kind of interrelated in a web, right? And so I would say that, Buddhism is not this, well, it is for some people. So some sects of Buddhism are very what I would call austere and orthodox, and what I would call even authoritarian, and maybe similar again, comparing to like the Catholic Church, where you have to go to mass a certain number of times, and then you have to say confession, and you have to take communion so many times per year, and if you do certain things, you're excommunicated, and you have to believe this, and you have to believe that, and you have to believe in the virgin birth, and you have to believe, there's just a whole, just over the centuries, right? There's just been this whole like add-on of like the telephone game of things, papal indulgences, the things that Martin Luther, the Protestant reformer, fought against, So, back then in the 1400s or 1500s, I can't remember which it was, but when Martin Luther was kind of nailing these 95 theses on the wall and kind of protesting against the Pope, and because the Pope, in an effort to raise money, was selling indulgences, so basically people could pay the church, the equivalent maybe of $100, and then that would get their grandmother or their mother or their brother or their uncle out of purgatory and into heaven. I mean, just really some kind of ridiculous stuff, right? Which eventually I think the Catholic Church got rid of that. I mean, they still have some pretty out there, kind of non-scientific stuff and beliefs, but at least I don't think they're overtly trying to sell salvation for money. Or they may be doing it implicitly, but not explicitly, I guess. I don't know. I don't want to accuse them of something, but so I think that, Buddhism really is just, you can really just kind of oversimplify it. It really is just, it's kind of a practice and a way of life, and it's really just kind of do no harm, be kind, don't be angry, try to ease your own suffering, try to help other people who are suffering, try to become self-aware, try to educate yourself about, the world around you and about yourself. And about history and how the world operates and the universe operates. And, we can't all know everything. Even Buddha, as enlightened as he was, did not know everything, right? He didn't know, and I know this might sound heretical to some more orthodox, non-secular Buddhists, but, I don't think Siddhartha Gautama Buddha could sit down and talk to you about quantum physics. I don't think he could have, he couldn't sit down with somebody and discuss like the internet, that didn't even exist yet. So I don't think he had, that he was a god. I don't think he was omniscient or omnipresent. He was just a very self-aware, kind, compassionate person who was a great teacher. Who taught so well that his teachings remain, here 2,500 years later, right? So, Buddhism is, can be what I would call fun, I mean, chanting is kind of fun, right? I mean, especially when you're doing it with other people, and it just kind of has this soothing quality. And when you're chanting by yourself and you're kind of hearing your own kind of maybe monotone voice droning on, chanting Nam-myoho-renge-kyo, Nam-myoho-renge-kyo. But when you add other people into it with different harmonies, and different, female voices and male voices and bells, and it really kind of becomes a beautiful, serene thing. And it just helps relax you. And I think that when you're relaxed and meditating and chanting, whether that's silently or out loud, it allows your mind to rest, and to get kind of clear out the garbage. Give you the kind of time and space to learn and de-stress and be less anxious and scared and less suffering and all those sorts of things. So I would encourage anyone who would like to come to our Facebook page. It's Secular Lotus Buddhists. You can look it up. And sometimes because of the current pandemic, and most of the world being under lockdown, here I run what I call Dharma Abbey, a little bit of a joke on Downton Abbey, if anybody's watched that British show, but Dharma Abbey. So I have a Buddhist meditation practice room in my house. And if we weren't under a pandemic, I could probably fit 10, maybe 12 people in there. I would do, group ritual meditation practice with others. But right now what I do is I've been doing it through Facebook Live. Some of the chanting, both for people who already know how to chant Lotus Sutra-based chanting. And then also for people who are either entirely new to Buddhism altogether, or also people who are Christian and wanting to learn more about Buddhism, or Jewish, or Muslim, or Hindu, or from other schools of Buddhism, Zen Buddhists. I've had people watching from other Nichiren schools of Buddhism, so Nichiren Shu, Nichiren Shoshu, SGI, also called Soka Gakkai. And so I think that secular Buddhism is maybe similar in a way if you've ever read or heard about Unitarian Universalists. So they tend to be kind of secular. Some of their members are more theistic than others. But I think Unitarian Universalists have, people in their congregations who identify as pagan or Wiccan or Christian or Jewish or Hindu or Buddhist or, whatever the case may be. But generally, in kind of a non-theistic, more philosophical kind of way. And so I think that also applies to secular Lotus Buddhists, and then also to the secular Buddhism kind of grassroots movement in general. I think it is a movement. And I think, especially right now during this pandemic, I've been locked inside because I'm at risk for I think like 10 and a half weeks now here in California. And it's hard. People are suffering. They're stir crazy being locked inside. They're lonely, they're depressed, they're anxious. They turn on the TV and see, oh gosh, millions of cases. New York City, tens of thousands of people have died. People have lost, something close to 40 million people here in the US have lost their jobs. It's happening, widespread across the world, right? So it's kind of like this plague, and people are afraid of catching COVID-19. And everybody's wearing masks and gloves, and restaurants are closed and businesses are closed and employees have been laid off or fired and businesses have closed. And so people are suffering, emotionally, financially, in kind of every kind of way. And then they're also having to deal with loss, right? Because so many people know people who, either in their immediate family or their friends network or their larger social network online of, people who have actually died, right, from this. And so there's people, there's just a real sense of suffering right now. And I think as a Buddhist, I think, I'm not saying everyone needs to become a Buddhist, but I think that there are things that we can, for those of us who are Buddhists or who are interested in Buddhism, I think there are things that we can do to come together as a community, to both help ourselves, our friends, our families, our coworkers or former coworkers, and even people we don't know, kind of a mutual aid type of situation where we're, actively trying to help ourselves and others. So, some people think that Buddhism is a very selfish religion or practice. I don't see it that way at all. I mean, they're very much self-awareness is very much a part of Buddhist philosophy and becoming aware of yourself, both your good parts and your bad parts. And certainly we do believe in karma, even those of us who are secular, but not karma in the traditional sense of, past lives, future lives, and rebirth, but more in the scientific sense that karma really is just the scientific law of physics of cause and effect. So good karma is, you do something compassionate or nice for someone, and then it kind of creates this domino effect of good consequences, hopefully, right? And then if you either intentionally or unintentionally do something quote unquote bad, then it could or can, it could create this domino effect of just bad things, which we call bad karma, which is basically just bad consequences in our current lives. So we try to focus on creating good karma both for ourselves and for others. So thanks for listening to me ramble. This is our first episode. I'm going to try to plan out the next episodes a little bit better. And if you'd like to leave me some messages on topics that you'd like me to talk about with you, another thing that I would like to do is maybe have some guests on the show, both people who are Buddhists, whether that's secular, non-secular, more traditional Buddhists, or just kind of people in general who don't identify as any kind of religion or practice, but who are interested enough in Buddhism to kind of want to at least learn more about it, even if they don't, might not yet want to become Buddhists themselves. So, very open, very flexible here. Not very doctrinaire, not very sectarian. definitely not very authoritarian. So please feel free to, voice your opinions to us, and we can do different things in different shows, kind of have talk shows with multiple people talking, and maybe take some Q&A from the audience, and maybe even have, kind of some friendly debates, between secular Buddhists and more traditional non-secular Buddhists. So just leave a voicemail message here on our podcast. If you go to anchor.fm, which is really awesome, by the way, I love Anchor FM. You can start up a podcast and it can get distributed all through iTunes and all these other places on RSS feeds and stuff. And it's the basic version of it is free. So I totally recommend it if you're interested in making your own podcast. So we'll see you online, or hear you online. Of course, because of the pandemic, we're using technology more and more to come together, and talk to one another and be social. So, using the podcast or Facebook comments and live stream, our website. I'm experimenting with using Zoom, and then also a more open source project which doesn't have some of the security holes that Zoom has had. It's called Jitsi, Jitsi. So I'm looking at different ways of maybe implementing that on our website so that we can do video and audio conferencing there. So anyways, I'm gonna let you go, and thanks for listening. And our email address is secularlotusbuddhists, plural, all one word, dot or period, Eureka, Eureka, which is where I live and where Dharma Abbey is, at gmail.com. I'm working on getting us a phone number as well. That'll be available soon. Our website, secularlotusbuddhists, plural, all one word, .org is our website. I'm being told that it will be up by tonight. Some updates and improvements are being done to it right now. I believe it's still offline. But you can always come to our Facebook page, Secular Lotus Buddhists. And we may get ourselves on some other platforms, like Twitter, which I'm a little nervous about because I really don't like the negativity on Twitter and the trolling wars and all of that stuff. But there are some very interesting federated clones, I would say, of Facebook and Twitter. That are open source and not run by, bajillionaires like Mark Zuckerberg. Mastodon is one, Friendica is another, Plume. There's a Slack alternative called Mattermost. There's a lot of different methods that we can communicate. And being a former Silicon Valley high tech guy, I'm very familiar with technology, so I'm kind of trying to figure out which ones to use, which are easiest to use for, because we have an audience of people who are highly technical and then people who are, a little bit more nervous about technical stuff. So again, shoot us any ideas you have, any comments or feedback. And again, this is a Buddhist show. Please be kind to one another, and to me, please. I don't really want to deal with negative trolling comments. We're not proselytizing. I'm not forcing anyone to be a Buddhist. None of that, right? This is all very open, just open discussion. So, anyways, I will leave you again with a little bit of what we call Daimoku, just so you can get, for those of you who aren't experienced in hearing it. And so I apologize. I am.